Tantor Audio, a division of Recorded Books, presents The Princeton Guide to Historical Research by Zachary M. Schrag, narrated by Peter Lerman. Introduction. History is for everyone. Historical research has been for me an area of joy and intellectual passion. I always feel a shiver of anticipation when I enter an archive or a rare book collection. What am I going to find? Natalie Zeman Davis, A Passion for History. In 2004, Afua Cooper walked the streets of Old Montreal, seeking the ghost of Marie-Joseph Angélique. 270 years earlier, Angélique, an enslaved woman, had been tortured and executed for setting a fire that burned much of the city. By telling Angélique's story, Cooper believed, she could tell a story about Atlantic slavery, about Canada's place in the Atlantic world, about an experience of woe and sorrow. Since much of the black past has been deliberately buried, covered over, and demolished, Cooper writes, it is our task to unearth, uncover, and piece it together again. This we are called to do because the dead speak to us. Not all history has been so deliberately buried, covered over, and demolished. Not all historical figures are silent ghosts. But, like Cooper, all historians believe they are called to unearth, uncover, and piece together a lost past. We remember what must not be forgotten. We tell the stories that must be told. These stories matter. 10 years before Cooper's walk, Roy Rosenzweig and David Thielen directed a telephone survey that asked 1,500 Americans how they engaged with the past. While a distressingly high proportion of respondents complained that their history classes in school had been boring and that they rarely read history books, a majority reported some kind of enthusiastic exploration of history through visits to museums, participation in hobbies, or, most of all, through the sharing of stories with family members. Using the past is as natural a part of life as eating or breathing, Thielen concluded. What we have in common as human beings is that we employ the past to make sense of the present and to influence the future. History-making, insists Gerda Lerner, is not a dispensable intellectual luxury. History-making is a social necessity. At National History Day competitions, students as young as sixth grade pose questions and share their findings. As they weave sources into stories, they engage in the same basic project as my colleagues in a university history department. Moreover, many of the contestants are perfectly capable of reading, understanding, and imitating some of the same works that I would assign to graduate students. Likewise, adults who do not think of themselves as historians take part in the great task. Over the years, I have worked with lawyers, architects, planners, engineers, ethicists, military officers, and other professionals, whether in the classroom, at conferences, or in oral history interviews. None has had any trouble understanding the goals of the historian or the importance of the work, and many have made significant contributions to the study of the past. Conversely, when I have worked with journalists, curators, public officials, and advocates to share some of my own findings in the form of newspaper stories, television documentaries, museum exhibits, or recommendations for public policy, I feel I have done pretty well at grasping their needs and making myself useful. I hope, then, that this book will reach historians from middle school through doctoral study and beyond, as well as those who identify not as historians, anthropologists, economists, geographers, political scientists, policymakers, sociologists, journalists, and nonfiction writers, but who want to answer questions about the past. One peril of any guide to research is that it will suggest that the process is more linear than it really is. Ski jumpers must perform their tasks in a set order: in run, takeoff, flight, and landing. If they deviate from this order, they have violated not only the rules of the sport, but the laws of physics as well. Figure skaters, by contrast, get to choose the order in which they will perform the various spins and jumps on which they will be judged. Writing history is more like figure skating in this regard. So long as you eventually perform all the tasks, the order is relatively unimportant. In point of fact, figure skaters get bonuses for moves performed later in their program. Please ignore this complication for the purpose of simile. In this book, I have tried to present the skills of the historian in what strikes me as a plausible order. In practice, you should expect to deploy these skills as needed, jumping back and forth, repeating some tasks, and skipping others. As William McNeil once described his process, "I get curious about a problem and start reading up on it. What I read causes me to redefine the problem. Redefining the problem causes me to shift the direction of what I'm reading. That, in turn, further reshapes the problem, which further redirects the reading. I go back and forth like this until it feels right." Two researchers with similar goals may differ widely in the tools and methods that produce the best results. One may work for an hour each morning, write a first draft in longhand, and never pause to outline or count words until they have a substantial bit of work on paper. Another may set aside one day per week for intensive work, starting with an outline, typing every word, and obsessively tracking progress. Some historians do not begin to write until they have gathered all the sources they think they will need for a project, transcribed key passages, and composed a complete outline. If that were the only way to write history, I would need to find another job. Even the individual historian must use multiple methods at different stages in a project. Sometimes you need to read a source closely, teasing out each nuance. At other times, you need to use outside information to put the source in context, or assemble hundreds or thousands of sources in order to discern a pattern. And just because one method works for one project, it may not work for the next. A work based mostly on primary sources has a different rhythm from one based mostly on secondary sources, and perhaps it demands different tools as well. Similarly, some projects and some researchers can take advantage of the very latest in computer technology and digital resources, while others will do just fine using methods similar to those employed by scholars hundreds of years ago. If a method works for you, it is not my place to challenge it. Rather, I hope in this book to document some of the methods that historians have used to pose and answer questions, to craft stories and arguments. Instead of telling you what to do, I hope to show you some options. Similarly, you should feel free to read the following chapters in whatever order makes the most sense to you. For example, reading the chapters on outlining and writing early may help you understand some of the chapters that precede them in the book. By learning the components of a finished work, you may have an easier time framing questions, identifying sources, and taking notes. This book mixes recommendations, I hesitate to call them instructions, with model passages from historians, showing various techniques in practice. As both a learner and a teacher, I have found such combinations effective, and I hope my readers will as well. If nothing else, I hope the examples show that most of the guidance in this book is not a set of arbitrary rules that I have devised, but rather a compilation of practices used by a wide range of historians across many genres and specialties. When judging the usefulness of my advice, do not take my word for it. Check the evidence I provide for its effectiveness. In selecting examples, I have tried to suggest some of the range of topics studied by historians, but I have not done so systematically. Instead, I have started with works I know I like, most of them about the history of the United States. Of course, each field of history presents its own challenge, and a general purpose guide like this is no substitute for mastering the existing scholarship on a particular topic and the tools that other scholars have developed to work with specific sources. But as I read the histories of other places and eras, I find most of the historians' tools to be familiar. I am therefore hopeful that the examples in this guide will prove useful far beyond the specific topics they address. I also hope that they will suggest some of the excitement of recent scholarship and inspire readers to track down the works from which they are drawn. Most of the examples are drawn from single-authored books, which have not only been a standard form of historical scholarship for centuries, but also give historians greater space to discuss research methods and sources than one is likely to find in articles, textbooks, museum exhibits, or other equally valuable forms of presenting historical knowledge. As argued in later chapters, the lessons of book writing apply to these other forms. A 10-page student paper or a 500-page book manuscript both need questions, sources, characters, plots, and arguments, and this guide aims to help creators find them. Moreover, as discussed in greater detail, books are composed of chapters, which themselves are often built from sections about the length of a 10 or 15-page research paper. Thus, if you want a sense of the scale of a topic that can be addressed in the length of a term paper, look for books with chapters explicitly divided into sections with their own headings. Then consider the questions and sources the historian used to write each section. Analyzing how successful historians built their stories will make you both a better writer and a better reader. Researching history is like collecting stamps, sewing a quilt, solving a jigsaw puzzle, and reading a murder mystery at the same time. Like any human endeavor, it is at times difficult, boring, and frustrating. But when the research all comes together, it is deeply, deeply satisfying. Have fun. Part 1. Definitions. The term history threatens to mean everything, and therefore nothing. If, as the wildest champions of big history claim, history encompasses not only the study of everything that has happened in the past 14 billion years, but also the prospects for the next 5 billion, the term has lost some of its precision. At the very least, we need to distinguish between history as the events of the past themselves and history as the study of those events. This distinction is analogous to the difference between plants and botany, money and economics. Beyond that, it can be helpful to consider history as the study of people's choices. And finally, we can present history as a set of values shared by historians. Chapter 1. Defining History. Over the centuries, historians and philosophers have offered various competing definitions of history. Charles Beard, citing Benedetto Croce, called history contemporary thought about the past. Conyers Reid described it as the memory, recorded or unrecorded, of past human experience. Mark Bloch called it the science of men in time. Most historians could likely agree to definitions along these lines, all of which suggest that history is the study of the past. And yet, at the risk of presumption, let me offer my own definition, one that argues that history is not about the past, but rather about people. History is the study of people and the choices they made. Tips: ask not what happened, ask what choices people made. Answer questions by telling stories. Understand your work as part of an ongoing search for knowledge that began before you and will continue after you. History is the study of people and the choices they made. History does not include every study of the past, for, as Bloch observed, a great many events of the past belong to scholarly disciplines other than history. He offers the example of the siltation of an inlet centuries ago. Once there was water, now there is land. There is no question that this change took place over time, an event. Yet, had natural forces alone caused that event, the best scholar to explain it would be a geologist. Bloch next tells us that the people of Flanders had both assisted the siltation by building dikes and channels, and that they reacted by moving the harbor of Bruges. With that information, we are firmly in the territory of the historian, though presumably the geologist would still have valuable insights to offer. To be sure, historians care about the power of non-human elements, natural forces, technologies, commodities, to shape and constrain human action. But objects alone do not make history. According to its subtitle, Marcy Norton's Sacred Gifts, Profane Pleasures, is a history of tobacco and chocolate, both inanimate substances. According to its introduction, however, it is the story of determined and frightened soldiers, zealous missionaries, resourceful plantation slaves, defiant Mesoamerican nobles, adaptive Indian commoners, mestiza love sorceresses, unsubjugated Carib Indians, cosmopolitan European humanists, crypto-Jewish Portuguese traders, lofty Sevillian merchants, worldly clergymen, scrappy sailors, reforming financial ministers, the patrons of smoky taverns, and the guests of well-appointed noble mansions. Now that's history. It is perhaps more controversial to insist that history is the study of choices, but I would argue that the interest in choice distinguishes history from the purely descriptive work sometimes done by archaeologists, demographers, epidemiologists, and other students of the human past. I am well aware that practitioners of these fields are often quite interested in the choices people made. When historians read words, they want to understand why people chose those words. When historians examine artifacts, they want to understand why people chose to create, acquire, and perhaps discard those artifacts. When historians trace pathogens, they want to know how people understood disease and how they tried to prevent it, heal it, or infect others. Norton wants to know why Europeans chose to adopt tobacco and chocolate in the forms they did. Many historians focus on people's choices about what to do, that is, their actions. Thucydides sought to explain why Athenians and Peloponnesians went to war after a 30-year truce. And for centuries, historians focused on similar choices of statecraft. In the 19th and especially the 20th centuries, historians broadened their view to include a great many humbler folk. But these people also had choices to make. At what age to marry? What job to pursue? Should they stay home or emigrate to a new town or a new land? Learn to read? Other scholars study people's choices not about what to do, but about what to think and feel, their thoughts and emotions. These can be elite intellectual histories, such as questioning why Margaret Fuller embraced transcendentalism, or they can tell the stories of how large groups of ordinary people understood the world around them. Whether the subjects are near universal experiences, pregnancy, death, or new phenomena, electricity, nationalism, explaining why a person chose one path and not another is the work of history. In studying choices, historians embrace contingency, the belief that had people made different choices, matters could have turned out differently. The concept is perhaps most easily grasped in military history. Soldiers fight and die in war because they believe that their actions on the battlefield will determine the fate of nations. Historians believe this as well. Thus, in his epic history of the Civil War, Battle Cry of Freedom, James McPherson identifies four major turning points that could have led to the granting of Southern independence and a world unimaginably different from our own. Northern victory and Southern defeat in the war, he concludes, cannot be understood apart from the contingency that hung over every campaign, every battle, every election, every decision during the war. Contingency appears in other genres of history as well. Historians describe as contingent the meanings that people ascribe to mirrors and to wilderness, and the decision by some societies to maximize profit rather than equality. Why did slavery expand in the early national United States? Asks Adam Rothman. The expansion, he argues, emerged from contingent global forces, concrete policies pursued by governments, and countless small choices made by thousands of individuals in diverse stations of life. Similarly, Alan Brandt does not believe that Americans were destined to take up cigarette smoking. Without resorting to a set of fantastical counterfactuals, he writes, it is clear that the history of tobacco might well have followed different routes and taken decidedly different turns. Following the cigarette through the century offers a fundamental opportunity to evaluate the contingent nature of historical change. The opposite of contingency is determinism, the belief that a particular outcome was inevitable. Geography, technology, or some other non-human factor forced people to act as they did. Historians generally hate this. If a historian calls you determinist, you have been insulted. Closely related to contingency is the concept of agency, the power of people to shape the world in which they live. Historians have long attributed such power to princes and generals, but only relatively recently have they attributed agency to humbler people: women, defeated industrial workers, slaves. Even when constrained by those with far more power, they argue, these people could engage in small acts of resistance. As Naomi Lamoureux explains, many historians hope to show that ordinary people in some group, typically defined in terms of race, class, gender, or ethnicity, had agency, that their lives were not completely determined for them, that they had space to make their own choices. Historians do recognize that contingency and agency have their limits. No individual is powerful enough to snap their fingers and change the world. While Franklin Roosevelt could have done more or less than he actually did to better the conditions of African Americans in the 1930s, he could not have eliminated race prejudice by executive order. And he was an unusually powerful president. Most people have less power, less agency. History encourages us to be more compassionate toward individuals navigating few choices, writes Marcia Chatelain. And history cautions us to be far more critical of the institutions and structures that have the power to take choices away. The task, argues Frederick Loggeval, is to balance out the elements of human agency, on the one hand, with impersonal forces, on the other, and to write history that strives to stitch together persuasively all the causative factors and to take into account their interaction. Or, as Karl Marx memorably put it, men make their own history, but they do not make it just as they please. They do not make it under circumstances chosen by themselves, but under circumstances directly encountered, given, and transmitted from the past. The tradition of all the dead generations weighs like a nightmare on the brain of the living. History is a means to understand today's world. As Louis Gottschalk noted in 1953, historians have long debated whether it is more important to understand the past in its own setting, to appreciate history for its own sake, or to understand the past in order to throw light upon the present. Some historians seek to expunge present concerns from their work. Obsession with the events of the moment prevents the historian from exercising the faculty of empathy, the faculty of describing how people, like us, but different, felt and behaved as they did in times and places similar to, but different from, our own, Oscar Handlin argued. The writer or teacher interested only in passing judgment on the good guys and the bad will never know what it meant to be an Irish peasant during a famine, or the landlord, an Alabama slave in the 1850s, or the master, a soldier at Antietam, or a general. Perhaps, but as Handlin surely knew, without interest in, if not obsession with, the events of their own moments, historians would not have begun to care about Irish peasants, Alabama slaves, and other people previously neglected by historians only interested in the powerful. Other historians embrace the present. The creative historian lives a double life, writes John Higham. Responsive on one side to the questions and issues of his own age, faithful on the other side to the integrity of an age gone by. Today, some historians, including those who may not identify primarily as historians, work in that tradition, studying history specifically to extract perspective on the present. Historians of sexuality study the past in part to understand the range of human behavior and to suggest ways that sexual minorities might achieve liberation. Historians of medicine explore ways that previous generations understood physical and psychiatric ailments, in part to remind current practitioners that today's diagnoses are not the only ones we could imagine, and that older conceptions of disease can help us, both doctors and patients. Economic historians study wage gaps over history, in part to explain why they persist today. And knowing that some judges seek to interpret the Constitution based on what they believe to have been the conditions under which it was drafted, legal historians and legal scholars document those conditions. Introducing a book about presidential impeachment, published during investigations of President Trump's conduct, Jeffrey Engel admits the obvious. You are most likely reading this book because of impeachment's contemporary salience, he tells his reader, and also because you realize history matters. I don't see a bright line between past and present, notes Thomas Segrew. It's a fallacy to see the present as somehow uprooted from history. The opportunities and constraints that we experience in the here and now are the result of historical processes. And the world in which the historian lives will inevitably shape their scholarship. For better or for worse, today's cutting-edge history becomes tomorrow's relic. In 1949, Conyers Reed argued that history has to be rewritten for every generation. We ask different questions of the past from those our fathers asked, emphasizing considerations which our fathers ignored, and ignoring considerations which our fathers held to be of paramount importance. The older historians move in never-ending march from our studies to our attics, and from our attics to our dustbins. For today's historians, Reed's gendered language is further evidence of his point. By writing only of fathers and not mothers, he himself took a step up toward the attic. Historians' debates are not simply academic in either sense of the word. They are neither confined to the university nor irrelevant to decision-making. Stories of the past can comfort us or they can challenge us. They drive debates over museum exhibits, the naming of roads and buildings, the selection of school textbooks, and, most prominently in 2020, the pulling down of monuments to men who have expanded or defended slavery. Historians challenge collective national narratives, expose wicked deeds by national heroes, and generally attack the notion of a good old days to which we might return. Many historians cannot escape the political implications of their findings, even if they wish to. Nor can politicians escape history. As Seth Kotler and Richard Ellis argue, U.S. leaders spend so much time making historical claims and manipulating historical symbols that we should consider the president the nation's historian-in-chief. With or without historical knowledge, decision-makers are apt to reach for historical analogies. Ideally, they will have a range to draw from. You always benefit from knowing more history, notes political scientist Gary Bass, than when you go through the world with only one historical example in mind and everything looks like Munich or everything looks like Vietnam. Thinking with examples can include asking, what is the best outcome we can imagine and what is the worst? How might this situation appear to other people involved? What did previous generations fail to anticipate? And what questions should we be asking to avoid the same mistakes? What human beings have done in the past, the enormous range in ways of living and possible actions, argues Natalie Zeman Davis, is a source both of hope and despair. We can draw hope from it in the sense that if things have been different in the past, perhaps we're in a position to make them a little different today, at least a little bit different. The most explicit efforts to use history to shape today's world are variously called applied history or public history, which the National Council on Public History defines as the many and diverse ways in which history is put to work in the world. In this sense, it is history that is applied to real-world issues. As historical consultants, museum professionals, government historians, archivists, oral
sample complete. Ready to continue?